Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Countless books and articles have been written about Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker. Probably most people, what they know about them, they know from the 1967 film that starred Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway. And in all these various depictions of the life of these two individuals, they've been portrayed as brilliant, as glamorous, as cool under fire. But our guest for this hour, Jeff Gwynn, says that nothing could have been further from the truth. He says that Bonnie and Clyde were among the most inept crooks in American history, who bungled almost every stick-up they ever attempted. This morning in this part of Focus 580, Jeff Gwynn will talk with us about his recently published book, Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde, published by Simon & Schuster. Jeff Gwynn's an award-winning author of both fiction and nonfiction. He's a former journalist, makes his home in Fort Worth, Texas, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome, like always. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call in. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions, comments are certainly welcome. We just ask people to be brief so we can keep moving, but anybody is welcome to call. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Gwynn, hello.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Just fine.
Good. Appreciate you giving us some of your time. Certainly, one of the things we know is that at the time that Bonnie and Clyde were alive and on their crime spree, they got tremendous amount of attention in the media of the day. It was huge. The story fascinated people, and they couldn't get enough of it. And it seems that in subsequent years, it still had an attraction for people. And certainly the film, for a lot of reasons, this film in the late 60s had a lot of impact on, at least on filmmaking, if nothing else. So I suppose that invites the question, what do you think it is about these two individuals and about their story? And we'll acknowledge the fact that the reality and the legend are somewhat different. But what do you think it is about this story that has been so compelling and grabbed so many people for such a long time?
There's a couple factors, really, and first, if we look at the entertainment value, when we consider Bonnie and Clyde's story, it's got all the elements that people love. There's young passion, it's a definite love story. There's people flouting authority. You can't make me do what I don't want to do. Bullets go flying. We've always liked stories about gunslingers. Then there's the whole criminal element, will they be caught or not? And finally, there's what in terms of just storylines might be considered a very satisfying ending. They do go down together in a bloody ambush, and just consider how much less interesting they probably would have been if instead of dying in that ambush, they'd been arrested, each gotten long prison terms, and ended up living out their lives as sort of scrawny old folks who had a few adventures way back when. So in terms of just an entertaining story, you have that. But even more so, it seems to me, Bonnie and Clyde were the first national celebrities created by the modern media. When you think about the times they lived in, the late years of the Depression, particularly in 32, 33, 34, when they're at their most active, America's desperate for some kind of entertainment to get their minds off their troubles. I know it's impossible for your listeners to imagine a time when banks were considered the bad guys, the villains, and when print media was drying up because nobody wanted to read stories that were mostly bad news anymore. So the media sort of struck on them as this great sort of scandalous entertainment. And thanks to modern media that wasn't in place just years before, like National Wire Services, pictures of Bonnie and Clyde could be in every paper in the country the day after they did something. they could be depicted as something far more than they were. They were a couple of poor kids from a Dallas slum who were god-awful criminals. They bungled nearly every job they tried to pull. But they were built into criminal masterminds because those kinds of stories sold newspapers and magazines. Mm-hmm. So you've got mythology being created instantly, and the story itself has all the elements that people traditionally love to read about or hear about.
Yeah. There is this, I suppose, part of the story is, as you say, there is this sense that what you're doing is you're watching people kind of careening down the road at breakneck speed, and you know sooner or later they're going to hit the wall. It's just kind of a matter of when. And it seems that they actually, maybe Bonnie more than Clyde, there's some reason to believe that that's the way they also saw themselves.
Oh, very much so. Bonnie Parker, from the time she was a little girl, her ambition was to be famous. She used to tell her family she would either be an actress in Broadway musicals or one of those very ubiquitous millionaire poets who, you know, whose work makes them so wealthy and famous. And she believed the movies that she went to see. She loved the romance of them. And to become famous was her dream. She didn't get famous the way she expected, but she still loved the celebrity. Clyde was less interested in celebrity than he was in being seen as someone important, someone who mattered. You've got to remember, they both grew up desperately poor. And this was in a time in America where kids stayed in the economic level that they were born into. If they hadn't done the things they did, which, don't misunderstand me, were unforgivable, there were lots of desperate poor kids who did not go around killing people. But if they had done that, Clyde's greatest accomplishment would have been working in the line in a factory, and Bonnie would have been a waitress until she couldn't hold up heavy trays anymore.
Some of the most famous, maybe all of the really famous images that we have of them are photographs that they took of themselves and that fell into the hands of the authorities. This is getting into the story a little bit, but it fell into the hands of the authorities by accident at a point where the police kind of stumbled upon them. There was a shootout. They had to leave very quickly. They left some stuff behind, and one of the things that they left was some undeveloped film. And so the authorities grabbed this, and they had the pictures developed. And there were these what turned out to be very popular, very sensational pictures of them posing with guns and posing with their cars and posing with each other. Just really wonderful. I guess it's okay to say they're wonderful images, and they still have, I think, great impact and help to add to their appeal. You sort of wonder who it is they thought they were taking those pictures for, and were they, in a sense, family snapshots, or did they think that they were actually something other than that?
This really touches on two important facets of the Barrow Gang story. When Bonnie and Clyde were growing up back in West Dallas in the 20s, again, desperately poor in one of the worst slums in America, for the poor kids there, one of the great treats was to go to an area of Dallas called Fair Park that would have amusement rides and different booths and so forth. And for a nickel, even poor kids could pose for goofy pictures with each other. You get three photos in a strip, you pay a nickel for that. And the girls would be having these parasols and big hats they would put on, and the boys would hold rubber machine guns with the barrel drooping and maybe pose behind rubber bars like a prison cell. It was just a bit of escapism, a little playtime in lives that were otherwise pretty much hard and hopeless. And once Bonnie and Clyde were out on the road sort of living out their adventure and hoping to last a little while and have some fun, the pictures that they would often pose for with their cameras would be the same kind of goofy things they posed for as kids in Fair Park, only they'd be pointing real guns. The pictures you refer to are really what changed Bonnie and Clyde from regional rumors, let's say, to national legends. Up until April 1933, the Barrow Gang was only known in Texas and parts of Oklahoma and New Mexico. And they were more or less minor league crooks who the regional papers were trying to build into something bigger so they could sell more copies. Just before Bonnie and Clyde got into Joplin, in April of 1933, and that's along with Clyde's brother Buck and Buck's wife Blanche and the fifth member of the gang, 16-year-old W.D. Jones. They posed for some more of these funny pictures. And one in particular had Bonnie in a very unladylike pose with her leg hiked up on the bumper of a stolen car, pistols in her hand, and a big stogie is sticking out of her mouth.
Mm-hmm.
She got the cigar from W.D. Jones, who was trying to smoke him so he'd look older than 16 years. Bonnie just smokes cigarettes like most proper women. So these pictures are an undeveloped roll of film. In the middle of April, there's a shootout in Joplin. The Barrow Gang barely escapes, killing two policemen in the process. And the police find these undeveloped rolls of film. When they have them developed in the lab, there are these absolutely scandalous pictures. And thanks to the new National Wire Services, those pictures of Bonnie and Clyde can be in the Joplin paper one day and in every major newspaper around the country the next. And those images are what blew the Barrow Gang right up to the very top of the criminal celebrity heap. Because otherwise you had Dillinger, you had Pretty Boy Floyd, you know, much better criminals, but Bonnie brought the element of sex into it. I mean, there was some glamour here. And the funny part was, she was thrilled about all of it, except the fact that from then on, everybody would refer to her as cigar-smoking Bonnie Parker, and she would be adamant every time they kidnapped a lawman for a while and released him, or they met anybody who would talk about them later, asking them to tell the press that she didn't smoke cigars.
Yeah. I guess one of the things that they did, though, learn was that if they were going to take pictures of themselves with their cars, that they needed to cover up the license plate.
That's one of the funny things. You can tell when you look at pictures of Bonnie and Clyde posing with their stolen cars where in their criminal careers that would take place. The pictures of Bonnie and the pictures of Bonnie and Clyde that they found in Joplin clearly showed the license plate of the latest car they'd stolen. And in later pictures, you'll always find that they put a coat or a hat over the license plates. They weren't very good criminals, but they weren't dumb either. And they learned from that particular mistake.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Jeff Gwynn. He's a former journalist. He has written both fiction and nonfiction. He's the author of a new book, Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We have a caller here. Others, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Caller here is in Effingham. Line 4. Hello.
Thanks again. I want to, I can by verbalizing, bear out the author's escapist mechanism that developed or evolved in the 30s with, you know, from silent pictures to some talking pictures. My family, my extended family, grew up in southern Indiana in the stone quarry section and coal mining. And my father told me this story. I was born in 1934 myself. I don't remember a lot of hard times because I was too young. But nevertheless, he would reiterate stories about things that happened down there in a small little town, I think it was called Tarpey Town, in north of Bedford somewhere. And a man had a little theater. And in these hard times, he would get a film and show it, and whatever the escapism, you know, satisfied the lookers. But it was a dollar a head in those times, and he always had a full house because people were so crunched by what was going on around them that they couldn't bear, and they had to go laugh or whatever the film would be. But I just want to reiterate that as my experience from, you know, I didn't see him, but my father, who was a young man, experienced that. So I just want to confirm, you know, the escapism that is still with us if we bother to look up. And thank you very much, Dave.
All right. Well, thanks. I don't know if there's anything you'd want to add to that.
Well, it reiterates the point. One of the reasons Bonnie and Clyde became national icons is that people desperately wanted to get their minds off their current troubles. People didn't really believe the Depression would ever be over. In a lot of the country, the Dust Bowl was just obliterating housing and fields and farming. So they could go to the movies and see the newsreels with Bonnie and Clyde in them. They could buy the true crime magazines. Not only do you get great entertainment, but you get sort of the vicarious thrill that apparently somebody's sticking it to the people who are the enemy, the banks, the government, and the frustrations that were typical of the time were part of what produced the legend of Bonnie and Clyde. Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could talk a little bit more about their lives, their individual lives, before they met.
The whole thing that surprised me in writing this book, we've had books, and we certainly will have books, that can basically list, okay, the Barrow Gang did this, they did this, they did this, in this order. And that might answer the when question, but what I wanted this book to do was also look at why. Why would two young people be so willing to knowingly pretty much sacrifice their lives for a few years of importance and, from their perspective, fun? Clyde Barrow moved to Dallas when he was 15 years old. He and his family lived in a campground in a slum across the river from the city. And we are talking about the most god-awful living conditions you can imagine. The Barrows were so poor in this tent community, they didn't even have a tent. They had to sleep under their wagon. Clyde's father was a junk man. He would take his horse and wagon in these streets of Dallas that increasingly had cars roaring down them and go up and down residential neighborhoods hoping people had thrown away metal household objects he could take to a foundry and sell them for pennies on the hundreds of pounds. There was very little food. Mostly they had to eat Salvation Army bologna sandwiches, if they had that. When Clyde quit school and tried to go to work in Dallas factories, he made a dollar a day. Yet here you have an ambitious kid who can look right across the river and see these shining skyscrapers, who wanted desperately to have nice clothes and a nice car, and was actually willing to work pretty hard for them. Except in the jobs that he would be allowed to fill, you'd barely make enough money to subsist. There was nothing for luxuries. Bonnie was the daughter of a brick mason and his wife who lived out in West Texas. When she was three, her father died, and her mother had to take Bonnie and her two siblings to live in West Dallas. And Emma Parker, Bonnie's mother, went to work as a seamstress in an overalls factory. She made $9 a week. Bonnie was an excellent student in school, but there was no reason for her even to graduate from high school because a poor girl from West Dallas in those days could be a waitress, she could be a maid, she could work in a factory, or she could be a prostitute. Those were basically the employment possibilities. Bonnie got married when she was 15. She was married to someone else the whole time she was with Clyde. Her husband was a thug who was a bank robber and who deserted her three times before he got sent up to prison. The reason she got married is the reason a lot of poor West Dallas girls did. It was the one moment in her entire life when she might have the chance for a little romance, a little happiness. So they're basically coming from backgrounds where they have nothing. And when they met in 1930, there was no future for either of them. It was pretty much love at first sight, and for all the bad things they did, and they did a lot of them, and for all the mythology about them, they truly did love each other. It was a genuine love story. Mm.
So at what point do we know at what point after the two of them got together, they decided that their best option was crime?
Well, we can actually pinpoint that pretty well. Clyde and Bonnie had only been dating a few weeks when he was arrested on multiple charges of car theft and ultimately was convicted and sent to prison. Bonnie promised she'd wait for him. Clyde got sent to Eastham Prison Farm in Huntsville, Texas, an absolute hellhole where the prisoners were treated like slave labor and the guards could discipline them in any way they wanted to without fear of recrimination. Clyde, after he was there, was repeatedly raped by another inmate, a trustee. And after months and months of this, he killed the man. It was the first murder he ever committed. And another prisoner took the blame for it since he was already in prison for life and Clyde was young and might be eligible for parole. A couple months before Clyde was unexpectedly paroled, he cut off two of his own toes with a hoe because the work details he was getting in the field were just killing him, and if he crippled himself, he had some hope that he might at least get an easier job inside the prison walls. He limped for the rest of his life. When he got out of prison and went back to Dallas, the Dallas police didn't want this guy, this young punk in town. He clearly stole a lot of cars before he left. They expected the same thing to happen when he was back. And so for the first couple months he was out of prison and getting jobs in Dallas, the police would routinely come by and arrest him on suspicion. In those days, you could just do that, haul somebody down to the jail and question them about a crime. He was never convicted of anything in those months. They'd question him, and then he'd be 3 or 4 miles away from the place where he worked, and they'd simply tell him to go back to work. He'd have to walk. And he was repeatedly fired from these jobs. So by March, he made the decision, and his mother wrote about this in an unpublished memoir that we were able to find and then use in this book, that he simply decided he wasn't going to be allowed to go straight. So he might as well be a criminal. And unfortunately, he not only did that, but to Bonnie, that sounded like a very glamorous existence, being the girlfriend of a criminal. And so they embarked on 2 years, which ended with their deaths and the unfortunate and unnecessary deaths of at least 11 other people.
Yeah, and it seems that as far as Clyde was concerned, that he, you know, part of the explanation for his behavior would have been the experiences that he had had at the hands of the justice system.
That's true, but let me emphasize again, it's true they harassed Clyde, but it's just as true that he was stealing cars right and left whenever he could before he got sent to prison, and his conscience did not seem to particularly bother him about that. But again, it's also true that when Clyde was in a Texas prison, there was no sense of rehabilitation for the prisoners. The philosophy was, let's make them suffer as much as we can, so that if they do survive and they get out into the community again, the condition they're in will be a warning to other people, don't try anything, this is what will happen to you.
I gather that there is some controversy surrounding Bonnie and her role in the criminal activities of the gang. Clearly she was an accomplice, but just what exactly she did it maybe is open to question. I think that, for example, there are some people who have argued, I think even people who were associated with them have argued that, in fact, she never shot anybody. There's some question about whether ultimately what happened to her was justified or not.
As near as it can be determined, and again, this is based on family diaries and memoirs that have never been published before, as well as testimony from Bonnie and Clyde to their families, Bonnie Parker may have, in fact, shot a gun twice in the 2 years. Once in a motel when she was trying to clean a gun and almost shot off her own foot. And second, once when the gang was trying to flee a bungled robbery, and as they're trying to race off from a downtown, an older man throws himself on the hood of the car and won't let go. And Bonnie takes out a gun, but she doesn't actually shoot at him. She shoots up in the air trying to scare him off because she doesn't want to shoot an old man, she said later. The theories that Bonnie had fired a gun and that Bonnie was an active murdering member of the Barrow Gang basically come from very false testimony from a man who on Sunday, April 1st, 1934, Easter Sunday, witnessed the Barrow Gang shooting down 2 motorcycle cops. And who claimed later that Bonnie stood over one of them and kept firing into his body while her victim's head bounced off the road like a rubber ball. In fact, that didn't happen. Later on, the guns proved that the fingerprints on that gun were those of Henry Methvin, another gang member, and not Bonnie's. But as I'm sure you know and all your listeners know, once people become celebrities, and there are a lot of wild stories about them, then it becomes easier to believe any extreme that's credited to them, too.
Mm-hmm. We're about midway through this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Jeff Gwynn. He is a journalist, also has written fiction. He's lives in Texas, Fort Worth. He's the author of a recent book. It's titled "The True." It's titled "Go Down Together." The subtitle is "The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde," and it's published by Simon & Schuster. And questions again are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the things I think is interesting is that during the time that they were involved in this crime spree, they still had contact with their families. What did their families think about them and what they were doing? And, we talked about on the part of the two of them, there may have been some sense that they would end badly. Did their family members think that somehow, maybe along the line, if they stopped, their ultimate fate would be different?
Clive's family, early on, and particularly after the first two victims died, were convinced that he was doomed. And they were convinced to the point that when his brother Buck was killed in a shootout, he was actually mortally wounded in a shootout in Missouri and died in Iowa a few days later. When the body came back to Dallas for burial, Clyde and Bonnie would always, at risk of their lives and freedom, come visit their families. They were very close to their families. Clyde's parents told Clyde that while they were burying Buck, they weren't going to buy a headstone yet. Since it was obvious Clyde would die soon too, and they were very poor people, when Clyde died, they could buy one headstone, and it would serve for both the brothers, and it would basically cost a lot less. Clyde not only understood, he told them what he wanted carved on the tombstone, which is "Gone but not forgotten," and that came true in ways he never would have expected. Bonnie Parker, and this is proof of her great love for Clyde, almost all the time, right up to the end of their 2 years of notoriety, probably could have turned herself in and gotten a fairly lenient sentence. Texas juries were notorious for believing women had no real common sense, and that whatever a girl like Bonnie might have done would have happened because she was just foolish and in love and wouldn't have known any better. And her mother and sister repeatedly begged her to turn herself in. She refused to do it. She said that Clyde would die sometime violently, she knew, and when he did, she wanted to die with him. That's the basis for her most famous poem when she wrote, "Someday they'll go down together, they'll bury them side by side. To a few it will be grief, to the laws a relief, but it's death to Bonnie and Clyde." They knew what was coming.
Yeah, that's where the title of your book comes from, that poem that she wrote.
Bonnie was, all during her time on the run, was still a very active poet. Clyde would steal typewriters, and she would sit in the back seat of the car as he drove, and she would type out different poems. We were actually able to get samples of some of her handwritten poetry to include in the book. She has wonderful penmanship, kind of pedestrian rhyming skills, and she loved quotation marks, and she would use about a dozen of them per every line.
That seems so odd. You know, that's just another one of the odd features of them and their lives that emerges from what you've been able to find out, that she would be doing that in the midst of this other stuff that was going on.
Well, in some ways, I think Bonnie always believed she was living out a movie adventure. And you've got to remember how young they were. Clyde was 24 when they died, and Bonnie was 23. Mm-hmm. And when you're that age, even when you say, "Well, I know someday they're going to get us," someday seems impossibly far away. What I really enjoyed speculating on was, what if they'd seen the movie that a lot of their current fame is based on? It has very little in common with reality. It's a wonderful movie, but the glamour and the excitement and all those things really aren't very factual. But I think it would have been the way, except in one way, that Clyde and Bonnie would have wanted to be portrayed for eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the one way is the idea that Clyde might have some problems in what we might call the romance department. That was a big part of the movie.
Uh-huh.
But we were, in fact, able to track down an old girlfriend of Clyde's before Bonnie. And her testimony, and she spoke with the air of one who was an expert, is that when it came to love, Clyde didn't have any trouble at all. So I suspect that part of the Beatty film would have bothered him, but he would have loved the rest.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone else here. Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Yes. Quick question on writing the book. Apparently you had access to both Marie and Kumi Barrel's unpublished memoirs. How hard was that to get?
I was very lucky, and a lot of times in a book when the author sits around saying, you know, I got something that's never really been in print before, he may try to give the impression that he's just a brilliant researcher. In my case, I was very lucky to make the acquaintance of Buddy Barrel Williams, Clyde's step-nephew, who is sort of the last of the family that talks to the public, and a local historian named Jonathan Davis, who was good friends with Clyde's younger sister, Marie. Kumi tried to write a memoir. She didn't get that far. She wrote several different versions of it, and Buddy was kind enough to give me the family copies that he had. Marie spent almost 2 years trying to write what she believed would be a real honest history of her family and her brother and his girlfriend, but when they were done, decided that these true things made the family look bad and refused to publish it. And Jonathan was kind enough again to make that available to me. I'm grateful to both of them, and I hope readers who care about Bonnie and Clyde may learn a few new things from the material.
You write in your book that Kumi Barrel's wrote in response to, or at least to clarify or set straight some of the writing in Jan Fortune's book.
Have you read that book by any chance?
Yeah, I haven't.
And you can see that in many cases there's a lot of very colorful, highfalutin speeches and scenes and so forth. And when the book was published, the Barrow family reacted very negatively to it. And Nell Barrow, who was the Clyde's sister and who was listed with Jan Fortune and Emma Parker as sort of the authors,
correct,
was adamant that she had just not said a lot of those things. And so the Barrow family did want to have their version of the record out there. The fact that mostly it never was published is not a reflection on what they wanted, but rather, I think, a reflection on they didn't understand very well how books got published or how to go about finding someone to work with them on them.
I see. Well, but they were able to capitalize on the event after the death, and they went on the road for a short time.
With Dr. Charles Stanley.
Correct.
After Bonnie and Clyde died in the ambush in Gippsland almost 75 years ago, Dr. Charles Stanley ended up leasing the car that they died in, taking it around to county fairs, talking about how crime doesn't pay. Most of the Barrow family and the Parker family actually served short prison terms for harboring offenses after the ambush. When they got out, briefly, Clyde's parents and his sister Marie and Bonnie's mother went out with the crime doctor. They weren't out on the road all that long. They didn't like it very much, and they returned to Dallas.
Very good. Well, it's an interesting book, and I think it's the capstone on all the books written about Bonnie and Clyde. It pulls it all together, and I certainly recommend it.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And again, for people who want to read the book we're talking about, it's titled Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and our guest is the author, Jeff Gwynn. Questions? Other questions? Welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. If people do remember the film, they remember the climactic event when Bonnie and Clyde die in a hail of bullets, and that certainly did happen. They were ambushed by police officers, and that, again, was something that was very controversial, or it seems like it was controversial because there are some people who argue that they should have been given the opportunity to give up. Particularly, there were some questions about whether, in fact, Bonnie herself had done things to deserve that sort of fate. At the time, were questions raised about the circumstances under which the two of them died?
They were raised immediately afterward. In January 1934, a retired Texas Ranger captain named Frank Hamer, maybe the only lawman in Texas who was as famous as Bonnie and Clyde were, was hired by the prison system to track them down and essentially shoot them on the spot. Hamer always insisted he didn't necessarily want to do that. He hoped to be able to take them by surprise, tap them each on the head with the butt of his gun, which was nicknamed in the press Old Lucky, by the way, and haul them off. The circumstances of the ambush have been cloudy through the years, whether the Methven family, Henry Methven was sort of the last member of the Barrow Gang besides Bonnie and Clyde, conspired with Hamer or not. We now have proof they did, and there's a lot of new information in the book. But Hamer and five other officers hid out on a hilltop in northeastern Louisiana. Bonnie and Clyde were set up. They knew they would be coming by at a certain time. All six officers who were part of that ambush, they did not necessarily like each other, and they each left, at least several of them, left records that are absolutely contradictory. And just about all of them wanted to claim to be the one who swore we have to give them the opportunity to surrender. Frank Hamer would say after the fact that just as he was about to jump up and say, you know, put up your hands, you're stuck, he didn't believe they would, but he wanted to give them the chance, that Prentice Oakley, a deputy from Bienville Parish, the local Louisiana county, panicked and fired before everybody else was ready. And one of the first shots he fired blew out part of Clyde's head and brain, and Clyde died instantly. There's a couple-second interval while the car that had slowed up by old man Methven's truck, for those of your listeners who are familiar with the movie, began to slide forward toward a ditch. And then everybody else opened up and fired about 150 shots. One thing all the officers agreed on is in that short interval, Bonnie had time to scream, and it was a high-pitched wail that haunted all six of them for the rest of their lives. Then they opened fire, and as Ted Hinton, one of the Dallas County deputies who was part of the ambush, said later, when we were done, there was nothing but a pile of bloody rags, and he was right. Later, a lot of people believed that they had not been given a chance to give up. There was some resentment that a woman would have been shot down like that. Later on, both Ted Hinton and Bob Alcorn, another Dallas deputy who was part of the ambush, both tried to run for Dallas County Sheriff. They were both soundly defeated, and both believed later it was because people resented them for killing a woman.
Another caller here. Line number one, Champaign County. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I enjoyed listening to parts of it. I have not read the books. I remember the old movie. One question. Did the speaker, or to the speaker, what about the episode with the Texas Ranger or Lawman Hamer? I believe the movie depicted as them actually picking him up during one of the robbery attempts or one of the robberies, or they captured him for a period of time and then let him go. I don't think I heard reference to that. But the other comment is that when people think, you know, this shouldn't have been done, or their end shouldn't have came the way it happened. Obviously, none of us lived during that time. And what we forget is there are other criminals of the 30s. That was the late early 30s. That was the heyday. The Dillinger, the Nelson, Kelly. These were very violent psychopaths. There's no question. And people viewed him as psychopaths, and I think in one of the FBI stories, I think it was part of either Dillinger or Nelson, and the townspeople actually cornered Nelson in the street, or one of them, and these were not lawmen. They were simply law-abiding citizens. And he was wounded, and he was down, and they simply walked up to him and shot him many times. And they didn't give it, you know, there was no compunction on the part of these law-abiding citizens. He was viewed as an absolute psychopath, a criminal who should be shot dead on site. So, I was just commenting that, you know, we didn't live through that time. There were innocent people killed during these bank attempts. You referenced some of that. So just curious on my comment and then my question.
Well, two things. First of all, I didn't reference Hamer having any dealings with Bonnie and Clyde before the ambush because he never did. One of the reasons he had two Dallas County deputies with him at the ambush, having never seen Bonnie and Clyde before, he needed someone to identify them before the posse opened up. He didn't want to take the chance of shooting two innocent people. Incidentally, when the Beatty movie came out, most of the remaining Parker and Barrow family members sued the studio unsuccessfully. But one successful lawsuit was brought by Frank Hamer's widow, who said that the things in the movie, her husband being sort of kidnapped and humiliated by Bonnie and Clyde, never happened, and she won a substantial settlement. So, no, that part of the movie, as much of the other parts of the movie, might be greatly entertaining, but they weren't true. As far as public opinion toward Bonnie and Clyde, from the time they nationally became famous in April of 1933 until the tide started to turn against them on Easter Sunday in 1934 when Bonnie was wrongly accused of personally murdering a young highway patrolman, they were not basically seen as murdering psychopaths who deserved death themselves. The vast majority of the public saw them with great sympathy. They were living out the dreams of a lot of frustrated folks, sticking it to the man, to the banks, to the law, and their victims. And again, please understand, I'm not saying there's any excuse for what they did, but their victims were given very scant sympathy. They were just sort of kindling to be fed into the fire of the Bonnie and Clyde celebrity. That some of the other major criminals at the time had their ups and downs in public opinion is undeniable. But please remember, Bonnie and Clyde had the added attraction of youth, young love. She's a girl in a time when women were considered ornamental rather than real functioning people. So for most of their time in the spotlight, I think it's safe to say that the vast majority of the people who were reading about them and following their misadventures, even if they didn't necessarily approve of what was going on, they kind of had a sneaking admiration for them.
We have just one thing, the caller, we have just about 5 minutes left. One thing that I'm really interested in having you talk about is the atmosphere immediately after when the car and the bodies were brought in. They towed the car into town, this bullet-riddled car into town, with the bodies still in it.
This is one of the most chaotic scenes you can possibly imagine. The ambush takes place 8 miles out of the small town of Gibbsland, and a tow truck is sent out to get the car, just bullet-riddled car with the two bodies in it, still in it, and tow this car back through Gibbsland and then 8 miles further to Arcadia, the county seat. Well, the gun blasts enough were able to attract a crowd into the woods before the tow truck even gets there. You get frantic souvenir seekers trying to cut off Clyde's ear and his trigger finger, locks of Bonnie's hair, bits of her dress. People are frantically trying to cut bullets out of pine trees by the side of the road. When the tow truck arrives and the car, remember, the bodies are bouncing around in it, covered by a sheet, towed through Gibbsland with a procession of a couple hundred cars with thrill seekers coming along behind it, honking their horns and yelling. The tow truck broke down in Gibbsland right in front of the elementary school, and all the kids were out at recess, and they swarm around the car, and they yank the sheet off their bodies. When finally the procession arrives in Arcadia, sleepy backwater town of a couple thousand, there are estimates of as many as 15,000 people jamming the sidewalks trying to get in. When the bodies are not autopsied, but just checked by the coroner, who announces that they did die by gunshot, when the bodies are identified, they'll be released to the family. Frank Hamer allows the public to line up and walk past to view them. And when gawkers are lingering too much, funeral parlor folks are spraying them from hoses with embalming fluid. It was chaos. It was crazy. It was the Roman bread and circuses at its most most hysterical point.
Yeah. And the there was so much interest in them that for years afterwards, the car, the bullet-riddled car, was taken around the country and people lined up just to get a chance to see it.
By Dr. Charles Stanley, the crime doctor. Eventually, there were three different cars purporting to be the original death car. But there was, in fact, only one, and as I understand it, it's now the property of a casino outside Las Vegas. You can still see it if you want to.
Yeah. It's just, I guess it the thing that you just can't quite get over is just how, and, you know, for all the reasons that you described, how it is this story captivated people at the time.
And it still does. I mean, in a couple of weeks, it'll be the 75th anniversary of the ambush. And still people want to know more. They want to read things into it. There's going to be a remake of the Beatty movie, I'm given to understand, starring Hilary Duff as Bonnie. We're going to have a whole new generation of American young people who are going to get swept up in it again. I just hope this new movie is a little more historically factual than the last one.
Yeah. Just to come back to one point, I think you've touched on this, but another of these points that people like to argue over the years was whether or not the two, Bonnie and Clyde, were betrayed by a member of their own gang.
There's no question they were. One other new thing in this book is we've been able to find some very primitive videotapes made by a Bonnie and Clyde amateur historian back in the 70s of surviving members of the Methvin family. And they, in fact, do lay out how the whole thing happened. The Methvin family wanted a pardon for Henry in Texas. Frank Hamer was authorized to negotiate it. They did betray Bonnie and Clyde. Didn't do much good. Henry was arrested not long later for murder in Oklahoma, extradited there, sentenced to death. Hamer argued on his behalf and got him off with a 10-year sentence instead.
You've talked about the fact that the families had, in one way or another, tried to benefit from being able to write the story, that also some surviving members of the family were pretty unhappy about how it is that their family members were depicted in the best-known version of the story, which is the 67 film. Is there any way that you could say that anybody who was related to them ever really did benefit from that association?
Not that I'm aware. The Blanche Barrow, Buck's widow, was the only one really still alive, and Warren Beatty paid her the rights to use her name in the movie. When she went to see it and she came out and the media wanted her reaction, she said, "That movie made me look like a screaming horse's ass." But Blanche did get paid enough to put a fence around her property in the country, so maybe you could say that she and she alone benefited a little bit from all this afterward.
Yeah, and that was, I think if I remember right, that was Estelle Parsons who played that part, and I believe that she received an Academy Award for that.
Well, she may have received an Academy Award, but I don't think Blanche would have given her any reward.
Yeah, true enough. Are there other things, you know, we've talked here on and off about there, a certain kind of image, a certain storyline was created, it was perpetuated by the media, and it's the kind of thing that has really come down to us all these years, and that what you're trying to do and what other people have tried to do is get past that and get to something of what was the real truth of these people's lives, who they were, why they did what they did. Are there some other things that really emerged to you as being, you know, powerful and important little bits of insight that would help to explain who these people were and why they did what they did?
Well, some of the questions I've been getting, you know, as I've been doing the national book tour to talk about Go Down Together, is people always say, well, why do we even need to know about them if they weren't very good crooks, you know, and personally they didn't amount to much? My answer is always, with Bonnie and Clyde, it's less important who they were than what they represent. What happens when young people in this country or anywhere feel that their lives are hopeless, that they have nothing to gain by living the way the law would require? And what happens in our country all the time when we take people and turn them into something to suit our own entertainment needs at the time? You can argue that Bonnie and Clyde, the first modern iconic creations of the media are really the forebears of Brangelina and people like that. If we learn more about who they were and what happened to them and why it happened, I think we understand ourselves better, and maybe there's some lessons we can learn.
Yeah, well, it certainly seems that our appetite for that kind of story and that kind of character is just it's never satisfied.
No, it isn't, and I'm willing to bet that there will be more movies about Bonnie and Clyde, and that poor Blanche will never get her just desserts in any of them.
Well, I think probably at about that point we'll finish up. If you want to read the story, the book we've been talking about, the title of the book is Go Down Together, which is a quote from one of Bonnie's poems, Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde. It's published by Simon & Schuster, recently out by our guest Jeff Gwynn. He is an award-winning author of both fiction and nonfiction. He's a former journalist. He lives in Fort Worth. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And Mr. Gwynn, thanks very much for giving us some of your time.
This has been a lot of fun, and your viewers, listeners, had some good questions.
All right, thank you.